You're listening to the Being Business Savvy Show, with your host Dr. Savvy. This podcast series aims to share best practice in the arenas of effective program and change management via relevant tools and techniques. We also feature exciting guests with incredible business insights and innovative ideas. Our documentary-style format helps to make knowledge sharing more fun, dynamic and engaging. If you'd like to be featured on the show, please contact us by sending an email to ttt@savvyleaders.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Now, on with the show.
I'm your host, Dr. Savvy, and every week we try to bring some amazing people to showcase their fantastic talents. And this time around, we've actually got Perminder Kaur Mann, and it's great to have you. I know you're a very busy person. You are CEO of Bonnier Books UK, and I read a book recently that your organization published. It was called The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which was brilliant, actually. So well done for getting that book. Thank you for bringing it to the world, and it's a very popular book indeed. So I really wanted to discuss three things today. I wanted to talk about, you know, you're in the publishing game or industry, should I not call it a game, and also everyone now can do blogs and they can go online and they can stream and can tell their stories. But when it comes to publishing, it's a very different story, isn't it? It's a very different, get a keyword there, story. It's a very different situation. You have to plan it properly. You have to make sure that you you structure it, not only the grammar in terms of the marketing, the complementary products, the fact that it has to go through a very strict publishing process. Because it's not that easy to get a book out, you know. So it'd be really good to get your views on that. And then finally, I recently saw that a very famous actor, a black actor, who got an award for celebrating diversity. Well, it reminded me of somebody who was once kind of pointed out, and they said, well, you know, maybe we should have Black History Month. And he says, well, I don't have White History Month. Why should I have Black History Month? You know, it's, and sometimes it's difficult, you know. What people are doing is they're categorizing people. It's fascinating. But my main point I'd really love to talk to you about is the kind of stories, you know. Are we getting enough stories coming through about our backgrounds, where we've come from, the stories of our fathers and mothers, the sacrifices that they went through to come to different lands? Those are great, compelling stories. Well, we'll come back to them in a bit. But anyway, let's talk about the first thing. Do you think anyone, Tom, Dick and Harry, can publish these days? I mean, they can with their blogs, can't they?
Well, yes, well, that is, well, first of all, thank you for having me on your show. It's great to be here. And on that, on the blog, yes, anybody can write now. Thanks to the internet, it's made a lot of, I think, platforms accessible in terms of communicating directly with your, you know, your audience. It's made that possible. And people are using all sorts of platforms like YouTube to make videos, Instagram, you know, Facebook. People are building profiles, and blogging, you know, it's been on the up for quite some time now. But it gives people the chance to sort of, you're not, there's no filters. You're in control. You write, you edit, and you put it out there. So I think, again, and social media is very much the same in terms of what people now read and see, I would say, is raw. And it's really raised a lot of interesting debates and topics about what is it that people want to consume. And we, as a publisher, often look at these platforms when we're looking for new content, just to see how, just to see the level of interest, I suppose, and the level of engagement. So yes, if you have a busting desire to write, blogging's a good place to start.
But do you not think there's this, you're familiar with the term known as echo chamber, where, you know, people will kind of say something and then, oh, they heard it somewhere else, and then it kind of, you know, it kind of comes down the line, or people just kind of identifying with a particular cause just to kind of influence their presence to become more popular, but don't really believe in stuff. So you get a bit of dilution of that content, because I'm not saying it's a wrong thing that when Black Lives Matter, everybody on their Instagram made their pages black, but do they really understand what Black Lives Matter actually meant? Or were they doing it because they were following a trend? So there is that danger as well, isn't there?
And that's exactly what happened when the Black Lives Matter movement. Well, that started years ago, but the recent events, unfortunate events around George Floyd Webber, when people started posting that black screen, a lot of you noticed within 24 hours there was a backlash. That what does this actually mean? You need to support this. Needs to come with action. And as a business, when we sort of we made a stand against that, but we did it in a way where we donated to charities that supported the movement or support or some causes. And within our industry in particular, we supported inclusive and diverse publishers, little indies that were struggling because of COVID. And we felt, you know, that we need to get behind them because the industry needs them. And that was our way of supporting the movement, by supporting them so they could be a platform for underrepresented voices. So again,
No, that's okay. No, I think it's interesting that point that you made. I was just going to pick up on it about the unrepresented voices, because I remember quite a few years ago, I saw a video that Jon Snow, Channel 4, brilliant newscaster, had presented, and he said, until the editorial team actually change, because they come from a particular background, just because you've got a brown face that's reading the news, or doesn't necessarily mean that. And I met somebody from one of the broadsheet papers, a particular pink-coloured one, and he was a writer who said that sometimes it's subliminal. You know, they're writing a story about India, they'll put some chap on there who's sitting on a rickshaw with his mobile phone. So the stereotyping of images, it's like, you know, what, like you said before, what is it in terms of the message that you're trying to put forward? And some of it can be distorted as well, can't it? Because other people have got other agendas.
Absolutely, and that is the trouble with what's out there on social media. It's unfiltered, it's raw. You have to, I mean, it's getting ever so more, it's becoming a minefield, actually, in terms of the amount of fake news, as we've coined the term now, that's out there. And so I tell my children, whatever you read on social media, just tread with caution. If you want quality information, go to a good source, a good trusted source. So if you want news, try and go to a trusted source, whether it's a newspaper or it's a social media feed, that you know it's coming from a good source, you know who the journalists are, you know where it's coming. And then otherwise you will just do play games with your head. You don't know what's true, you get conflicting opinions another time. And it's great in terms of giving people a platform for their voice, but that's how you should approach it when you read it. It's an opinion, it's someone's opinion, or it's someone's stance on something. It doesn't make it right, it doesn't make it wrong, it's their opinion. And as long as you read it with those lenses on, then the internet's serving its purpose. It's when people start reading it like it's their, I don't know, that the role BBC would have played once upon a time. They think this channel is now becoming my trusted source of information, but you don't know what the political agenda is behind that, or whatever the agenda is and the motive is. So you have to be careful. And that's, again, we talk about the job that I'm in, is in publishing. Our job is to provide information to people, carefully curated, it's quality, from trusted sources. And that's our job, to do that, from a book perspective anyway.
Do you think curation is, I mean, that's a thing that I've been talking about for quite a few years, actually, about curation. You know, if you go to a museum, you know, if you've got somebody who's going to curate a set of artwork, they may have done hundreds of pieces of art, but they might pick five particular items, and those five items can be spoken about in detail, you know, analysed in detail, presented to the public, put in a showcase situation. I guess the problem that, you know, the people that don't necessarily get into the mainstream is that the opportunity is not always there, right, because people are not actually, you know, being able to pick it up. Right. But also, isn't the publishing process a little bit hard as well? I mean, I think content for the sake of change is really, really positive. And it's unfortunate that in some countries content is blocked. You know, and we've seen this in many countries where, you know, people are trying to get the message out and it's just simply they can't do it because it's the internet's locked off, closed off. But coming back to being more optimistic, then sure, you can go to Kindle or you can publish a book. Right. But it could be a book amongst millions and millions and millions, and you'll never be able to find it, right? Mm-hmm. And also, what about the quality of it? Has somebody done proper, you know, graphics and the grammar being checked, or is there a PR machine behind it? Can you tell us a little bit about, I know that you were recently on Sky, as I mentioned earlier, you've had a lot of people interested in saying they'd like to get their book published. Obviously, you've got to go through the process to make sure that it's a story that would resonate with a particular target, etc. But what is the publishing process in brief? We could spend hours talking about it, but is there a set of things, that guidelines that people need to follow when they're doing it?
So, I'll give a generic approach. So if you are thinking of writing, albeit fiction or nonfiction, your starting point is to find, is finding a good agent who will, you get a writer's handbook, and in there they list all the different agencies. There's so many of them, and what their speciality is. But I think if you're new in this game, it is really, really important to identify an agent that's going to help you shape your work and get it in the right form for a publisher to review, because we get so many submissions every week, and our inboxes are inundated. And what makes something stick out is usually, obviously, we have our things that we're looking out for. But the quality, the actual shape of the writing, the condition that it's in, we'd say that doesn't need, hopefully that's not, we do hold new authors' hands. We've launched a lot of debut careers, but it is to some sort of state that then we can, you know, to review, because if things come in too raw, it's very difficult for a publisher. So the agent plays a role in doing that. So I know lots of agents, I've heard, some don't all do that. So it's really important you find that agent that you connect with, have a good relationship with, that gets what you're doing. And then they then submit it to publishers. Now, depending on what it is, if it's something quite new, if the agent thinks this is a great debut author, they can set an auction started, or they might just submit it to publishers and see who's interested, to the right editorial team in each publishing house. Now, each publishing house, we have in our editorial team, we have like an adult editorial team, a children's editorial team, and then we have publishing, we call them acquisitions directors, who are known in the industry for the type of books that they publish. So they have a very strong relationship with agents. So the agents will know who to approach with what project. And then they will then take it into the business and then review with the business through, if they like it, they want it on their list, with marketing, sales, PR, to get their interest in there. And as long as everybody's interested, or passionate, or thinks there's an opportunity with this project, will then make an offer for the book and then acquire the book. And then it's a long process. Then they start the process of actually shaping the book, so that it goes into the editor's hands, and they work very closely with the author on shaping the story, structuring it, editing, proofreading, all of that. And then same time, marketing starts seeding the book with retailers. Publicity machine sort of starts kicking in sort of 3 to 4 months before the book's published. And depending, again, because every book's different, the time frame from acquisition through to publication, we could be talking between 18 to 24 months. And then the sales kick in. It's a long journey. And I think, you know, again, it's really one of the things that have been very topical in our industry is diversity, is representation. And do we have enough diversity in the industry? And the answer, frankly, has been no, we haven't. And it's been quite a closed shop, I guess, for some communities publishing. I mean, I joined publishing many years ago, but I never was aware about publishing. I accidentally landed in publishing. I went for a sales job, and it just so happened it was in the publishing industry, and I actually loved books, and I couldn't believe where I was, and I thought, I'm staying here now, because I actually loved books. I wasn't actually aware of a career in publishing. I just thought books, when I was a child, I loved them, that the author somehow managed to write this book and they ended up on shelves in libraries and shops. I had no idea about the process behind it and how complex it is, and that it's an actual business. So when I accidentally sort of arrived in this place, And people then talk about like, okay, why don't we have much representation in the industry? Well, it's, you know, it's one of those industries where it was not what you know, it's who you know. And all the low level entry jobs when you come in, I mean, they're very low paid when you start. It's a media, it's very much like people enter the film industry or the music industry or, you know, theatre. You know, the publishing industry is very much, you know, in the similar vein. People have this, you know, aspiration to work in publishing from a very young age. So they are going through the channels, through colleges, through the same universities, through the same courses, and they have all the same network connections. And people give them, you go in, it's more London-centric. It's quite a London-centric industry. And when I said, you know, the salaries are very low to start with, so that becomes a barrier to entry as well. And you get certain class of people coming in who can afford to work for very little money. And luckily, ironically, because I had moved back home and was living with my parents, could actually afford to work for that salary. But most people, if you're trying to attract talent from around the country, you come to London, you wouldn't be able to afford to live on that. So that then becomes a deterrent for a certain class of people. And so over the years, it's just become very much carbon copies of each other. You'll see that everybody looks quite the same. They look of the same color, same background. And actually, I've discovered over recently, there's a lot of people who actually have come from different backgrounds. But when they come there, it's one of those things. You arrive in this industry and everyone speaks in a certain way and they look of a certain way. And you have this, it's just you just want to fit in. So you find yourself conforming. And I was guilty of that when I first started. Of course, when I arrived in publishing, I thought, wow, this is like a new world I didn't even know existed. But very, very soon after that, I started feeling a little bit like out of place because there was no one else that I could see that looked like me, spoke like me. And I thought, my God, I started questioning myself. I had that imposter syndrome. Do I belong here? And then I will now confess, started doing, you know, taking grammar lessons in the evening, special, just so that I was careful about my language because I was always a numbers person. And I thought, oh my God, I don't speak the Queen's English. How I'm going to get caught out. I never used to admit where I'd lived, where I came from, which was Southall. I lived in West London. All these things. I just wanted to fit in and blend in with everyone else. Which was, I think, was the problem with that industry because it wasn't me. I was many people were doing that. And I'm not just talking about people of color. I'm talking about people from, you know, working class backgrounds too that were white as well, just wanted to fit in. So I think that's we created our a problem over the years where everyone started looking the same. I luckily, I left the industry and started working with the core of the industry. I started working for independents, small businesses. And then I came back 10 years ago in this business, which was still an unknown company. We've pretty much grown in the last 6 years from a small little children's publisher to now being the sixth largest publisher in the country. And now I'm back. Amazing. On the main stage. Thank you. And so now it's suddenly we're aware that not much has changed in the last 2.5 decades. And I mean, it is happening, but it's slow. But I think, again, it's really important. It's not one solution. We need the gatekeepers of taste to change because until we have people represented across the whole ecosystem, that's not just in publishing. This is also at retail because they make the selections. I mean, I can say we can have all our writers come. Sorry?
Is there a fear amongst, you know, the establishment in terms of the established players to take a risk? I think they're interesting. There's a BBC mini-series, £15 million to make the programme. It's called The Suitable Boy. It was written by Vikram, I think it stars Taboo. I think it's a 6-part thing.
Yeah.
I think interesting.
It's, you know, a great book, by the way.
That mistake. But when that's quite a few years ago that book was published, but how much are people taking, coming back to the points you were making about wanting to fit in or a particular background of people that are there, does that make them think in a particular way? They'll only take risks on certain projects, right? If it kind of fulfills their criteria. I mean, that book is a very, very deep in terms of description, detail. I mean, I can't remember how many, it must be about 1,000 pages at least, you know, if not that, more than that. But the issue here is that there are many different stories. So does that mean that people are, because they're from different backgrounds, they're not willing to listen to those stories, or they're not aware of those stories? There's a bit of that Donald Rumsfeld, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? Because they're not exposed, because they've not had that conversation. Or could it be something even worse than that? That if you look at the British, for example, in India, they were there for hundreds of years. You know, they've left buildings there, they've left establishment there, they've left, you know, administration systems behind, right? Is there, even if you look at the story of Ugham Singh, right, you know, who last week was his anniversary of his particular situation, where he had been, he'd come over, and Michael Dyer was the guy at the Jallianwala Bagh in 1919, and he shot the guy at Caxton Hall. Now, that's a story, right? And there have been some movies. Do you think that certain people are embarrassed about revealing their past, therefore they don't want to discuss those stories? Or is it, like I said before, what they don't know, they don't know, because they're not open enough to be able to actually be presented with these ideas? Because it's not like there's not enough stories. There are plenty of them, right?
Yeah. I think probably a combination of both, but I think it's more probably leaning towards, I mean, I've worked in the industry, and it is such a lovely industry. The people are great. I think it's more complacency as well. And after all, it is a business. And so we have certain processes and criteria when we're reviewing projects when they come in, and they go through the same scrutiny every single time. So it's the same new measurements that we're measuring against previous books. So it becomes very, I don't know, systematic, in that when you're trying to bring something new in, it is risky. And do we take a gamble? And it's not so much, it's not just the actual writing in itself, which you're right, there's plenty of stories out there, well-written stories that we could publish. But it's about going on, as explained to you, it's almost a two-year journey, an editorial process from acquisition. So it's having the comfort to want to do that first, the passion. So a lot of projects are acquired on passion. So have we got the right people acquiring? Why would you be passionate about that story that you can't relate to or connect to, or not actually disinterested in? Because it is a two-year process. Then where I think it really becomes problematic is the sales, marketing and PR to make these books a success. Because when they take these gambles and then they don't work, it's like, well, tried that, but it was like, it just didn't work. It's just, you know.
The industry is not agile enough. I mean, there's the overused word, agile. I mean, use it in IT, use it in business, where they use this philosophy, which is test and learn, or incubation, or putting feeders out there. And as you described earlier on, if you've got, you have to seed it, you have to make sure it grows and it turns into the product that you want it to be. Why can't there not be a shortcut process that says, all right, we've got 15,000 people, right? Okay, we're going to release this, say, two or three paragraphs about the story. We're going to test to see whether or not that resonates with them. And if it does, that is not you spending millions, but you spending a fraction of that to test to see whether those particular elements of a story can actually come out and actually be worth something, not only for the person who's written it, because obviously they may have a mission themselves, but it brings the story to a wider field, but without taking the wider financial risk, which you would have to do if you went through the two-year cycle. Are any of those processes in place? But is there an opportunity for us to do that so we can get more and more people engaged from different backgrounds?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things I've been championing now, in terms of risk taking, the digital space allows us to do that. So one of the things that I'm looking at right now is setting up a digital first imprint within our business. One of those strands are going to be, you know, inclusive and diverse publishing, underrepresented voices. So we can probably control more, just do through ebook. Ebooks are so much easier. You don't have gatekeepers at retail, you know, saying, oh, that won't work, I've got to get the return on my shop floor space that I've got, and I've only got this X amount of space, so I'm going to give it to sort of like the no-brainers, the easy wins. We can experiment more, and we can actually target audiences through social media and find out where these potential, you know, audience readers are, and talk to them directly with even snippets of content, and indeed with the idea that if they love it, they can go and download the book. And if they then, if there's enough engagement with the ebook, then we can always roll it out on physical. So it's done the other way around. And that minimizes, brilliant, takes some of the risk out. So that is something I'm going to be looking to launch later this year. And we are doing that merely because I've been absolutely inundated with lots of manuscripts from people from all, not just people of color, but loads of different backgrounds who said, look, I'm just like, I need some help. How do I get published? And I just know it's such a labor of love when people write, and this is a good way to get something out there. And we can then help with the editorial side. We'll create a lovely jacket, put it onto our ebook platform, and that's another avenue to get yourself published. And that's the difference between working with a publisher or going to somewhere like Amazon and becoming self-published, because you can put your content out there, but it, you know, it's having all that support, making sure it's editorially correct, and also the marketing and the PR. Discoverability online is so difficult. I mean, it's great. Anyone can publish out there, but the kickback is discoverability, and that's the challenge, making sure people can discover you, because it's just so much out there. It's making sure that people find you, right? Finding the right keywords, the metadata, promotion, putting it, positioning, so making sure all those things, which is now. But I think it will open up doors for so many more other new sort of talent to come through. And yes, the stories are important. And again, as I said, today it's been difficult because of who the gatekeepers have been. And it's been purely because they don't understand, they don't connect, and it's complacency. It's a commercial decision versus what's the right thing to do. And actually, I think, you know, that's all going to change now. There's a big movement going on, and I think there will be change. But people who know me will know that I'm constantly saying this. Real meaningful change does take time. And I truly believe it's going to be generational. And I think, you know, our generations come through. Like myself, I said, I knew nothing of publishing. I was the first one to go to university in my family. No one knew. I didn't have any career advice. I went to a school that didn't really offer that. Parents didn't know much about opportunities. There was the standard stereotype stuff, you know, become, you know, a lawyer or an accountant or doctor. That's all they knew. So they didn't know about this. There's so many opportunities out there. So I kind of like, I've worked it out myself. Luckily, I've been motivated. I'm very driven, and I've created my own path and my own journey. And people often say to me, you know, it was really difficult, you know, has it been challenging? And I'm like, well, yeah, it has been, but I knew it was very early on. I knew it was going to be, and I actually just embraced it and thought, you
well,
know,
there's
I'm
a message
going to
in that as well, isn't it? That, you know,
yeah,
unless
I'm
you
like,
put
you
your hard
to,
work
like,
in, you know?
Yeah, you have to put the work in, and if you really want, why do you want the change? Well, our parents came here and they had their own set of challenges. My parents brought up, I'm one of eight. They worked all hours, worked numerous shifts to give us an easier life. It wasn't about them. It was about us. And I think, you know, I'm having a good life, but at the same time, I'm going to have to put in the work, and I'm going to have to embrace the challenges. They are going to be obstacles, but I'm paving the way for the next generation so that they are more,
I think you
are. It's easier.
You definitely will. I was going to say thank you so much for coming on. As I said before, you're a very busy person. I wish you continued success. You're definitely making a difference. Good to meet you. And I think whoever will come in contact with the organisation, I'm sure will do extremely well, because you're passionate about what you do. And I wish you all the best. And I hope to see you again.